in our practice together. Please do take care going up and down the stairs and so on, especially if you've been sitting late at night and are not used to it. Even if you are used to these retreats, do take care. Let me now continue with the Zazen manual. The first day we went through the first opening paragraph, wisdom and compassion, where we begin. Then we went through the physical posture, and then yesterday we went through what to do with the mind, huh? And some of the problems that may arise. Continuing, quote, coming out of meditation, move slowly and rise calmly without haste or roughness. Then at all times use appropriate means to protect and sustain the concentrated power of dhyana, as if caring for a babe in arms. Thus it develops easily. End quote. This is proper advice as we patiently and carefully work it through. And yet in our daily lives, we need to apply ourselves, pay attention to various things, various details. As lay people, this is where our focus naturally must turn: work, family, whatever, the red light, the green light. As practice matures, the concentrated power of dhyana remains as a kind of undercurrent through it all. It shouldn't be noticeable, but it should be there. Although some Zen teachers like to insist that once you've worked it through, no matter how you jump up or even leap out of your zazen, it cannot be lost. Fine. Now return to your practice with patience, care, and attention. The next paragraph. This is the most important task. If you don't practice calmly and quietly, in the end you will be completely lost. To search for the pearl, it's best to calm the waves with the water of concentration still and clear. The mind pearl reveals itself. End quote. This metaphor is a very famous one. I've used it myself in earlier lectures. But the beginning, this most urgent task, this is none other than the great matter of life and death, as it's called. It is indeed the most urgent, inescapable task. Conjure up, create all the pleasant fantasies you will. They'll be of no use when you're facing death or a real tragedy in life. This is the great matter of life and death. The pearl metaphor describes sustained practice to still the waves of mind and all sense experience. It also states that what we are searching for, the pearl, reveals itself. calm the waves until there are none. Then see what's there. That is not a fantasy conjured up, not some insight, state of mind, or sensuous experience. The metaphor is an ancient, ancient one. It goes back before the time of Buddhism. If you look in the sacred texts of Hinduism, the Upanishads, you will see the same kind of metaphor. The waves of consciousness, of the mind, huh? And then as they are stilled, the depth of the ocean is revealed, that boundless depth. The emphasis in those sutras tends to be the complete uniformity, the complete lack of distinction or diversity there. Buddhism, especially Mahayana Buddhism, kind of turns it on its head by making clear in many of the Mahayana sutras and also Zen texts, penetrating to the very depth of the ocean, we don't just lose ourselves in some muddled non-differentiation. Everything is the same. On the contrary, once we've really penetrated the bottom, how to say it, no self, being without self, comes forth as the boundless ocean itself. Through your seeing, through your smelling, through your tasting, through your touching, through your thoughts. Now, how to say, out of the source itself. And then whatever happens, the bell ringing, the car crashing, it is not outside of this. The way I put it was, the true beauty and dignity of each and everything becomes manifest. It's not lost in the depths of the ocean. It becomes, for the first time, truly what it is. The true beauty and dignity of each and everything. Each and every wave is, of course, seen to be none other than the ocean itself. The other, what you call the other, is none other than the self-same water. Oh, it takes a different form, naturally. Wouldn't it be a real drag if we were all the same? But being able to see, not conceive, but actually see that root in all, in each thing, each person, as it is, as they are, allowing them to truly be what they are. They are not separate from you. They don't lose their identity. They manifest their true identity. It's a wonderful metaphor, and it's very brief here. He just says, to search for the pearl, it's best to calm the waves with the water of concentration, still and clear. The mind pearl reveals itself. Very succinct. It's all right there. The next paragraph. Quote, thus the Perfect Enlightenment Sutra says that unhindered and pure wisdom arise from dhyana. The Lotus Sutra says that in a quiet place, one should cultivate the mind and let it settle so that it is as still as Mount Sumeru. Thus, to transcend secular and sacred, quiet meditation is necessary. To freely pass away sitting or standing is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana, end quote. Slowing down the mind train, huh? Slowing down the mind train through the concentrated power of dhyana is most helpful. It is going in the right direction. But the mind train and all sense experience must not just slow down, it must once come to a full and complete stop so that we can then see what is there. It's always been there, but we cannot see it when we're going 200 miles an hour. This, I would say, is the essence of Zazen. The fundamental error of 90, maybe 99% of Buddhism and Zen in the West is that it mistakes slowing down for the stopping that is the basis of Buddhism. We slow down, then we speed up again, then we slow down, then we speed up again. This is just samsara. This is the endless dis-ease, fiddling with itself, that's all. If you're going, I read the newspaper about 10 days ago before I came here, and in Japan, they're still working on a new kind of a Shinkansen bullet train, and they actually got it to go over 600 kilometers an hour. It won't be ready to, you know, for people to board and use for probably another 5 or 10 years, but 600 kilometers an hour, you know. It's still in its experimental stage, but they actually got it to go that fast. Huh? What do you think you see when you look out the window, huh? Not a hell of a lot. You don't see Mount Fuji, that's for sure. What was that? And of course, in our daily lives, when we see that our mind is going too fast, gotta slow down, gotta slow down. So perhaps we sit Zazen or take a pill. People do many things. But we realize the mind is moving too fast. We're losing control. We can't see a friggin' thing. So by whatever means, healthy or not, perhaps we manage to slow it down maybe to 100, even 75 miles an hour. Now you can start to see, that's a person walking. That's a car. It looks like a Datsun maybe. You couldn't see that before. If you don't get excited about that and then start speeding up again, if you have the discipline to realize, no, let's slow it down some more now. Get it down to 10 miles an hour. Now you can see the shoes of the person walking by. You can see what he's wearing. His top button is not buttoned. It's very clear. Again, the point of Buddhist practice is not simply to slow down because then we speed up again. Once, to bring that mind train to a full and complete stop. That is the essence of Zazen. And once you've done that, you're able to see what's under your feet. What is right outside the window? It's not anything new, but for the first time, we can actually see it in all its clarity. the pearl is manifest. It's unmistakable. You can see every facet of the gem. Then if you need to, you can start the train up again if you need to go somewhere. You could also get out of the train and walk around and see, is this where I started or not? What needs to be done here? Bringing the train of mind and all sense experience to a full and complete stop is necessary, but it's also the start of the real practice, the practice of awakening, the practice that is awakening. But first, to let mind come to its own end. That is the essence of zazen, whether working with a koan or just sitting. It makes no difference. If it's genuine, I would say that is what is happening. As far as I can see, it's basically true of other forms of Buddhism as well, but that's not relevant here. Fortunately, this is a Zen retreat, so at least we don't have to cover too much ground. You see the danger otherwise, huh, of just slowing down. Ooh, it's a lot clearer. And then speeding up, and then slowing down, and then speeding up, and then. The concentrated power of jhana then tends to degenerate into a kind of a temporary salve, a medicine. Too fast, so I slow down. Oop, too fast, so I slow down. Oop, too fast, so I slow down. It becomes a profound disease itself, doesn't it? At worst, it becomes an unhealthy escape from the turmoil, right? An unhealthy escape from the turmoil that we find ourselves in. That is not what Buddhist practice is for. Please beware of half-assed practice, sitting on only one side of the cushion. Otherwise, you see the danger, Allow sense experience itself to come to its own end. Then see what's there. You can't miss it. Now, where is the division between secular and sacred that is mentioned in the text, Who divides life and death? Death itself is not apart from this. And so it says, when the time comes, we sit and calmly pass away, or die standing, if you wish. It's a rather strange statement, but if you may remember the exhortations for those who do rouse the doubt, that same terminology is used. It was a set phrase. You remember? It's a very strange story where the master has passed away, and there's the senior monk who is supposed to take over, and the superintendent, who is very close to the master. The superintendent says to the head monk, if you have understood our teacher's teaching, I will gladly, you know, serve you just as I served our teacher. But tell me, and he mentions the basic expressions of his teacher, be like an incense burner in an old temple. Be like a single thread, a single sheet of silk, and things like these. Obviously, these expressions of just being complete, one unified mind. And so the head monk says, yes, they refer to the mind being unified. Then the superintendent says, you don't understand our teacher at all. Well, the head monk is incensed. How dare you? Why? This stick of incense, I'm going to burn it. And if I cannot pass away while sitting in zazen before this incense stick burns, then I will admit defeat, that I don't understand my teacher's teaching. Apparently, he actually did that, lit the stick of incense, and before it finished burning, the head monk died in zazen. He gave up his life to prove his point. Of course, the real point of this, it's a very interesting, it's in a Soto Zen koan anthology. So obviously this problem was there from the very beginning. This is 9th century stuff. This is early stuff. But the point is the superintendent at this point taps the now dead monk, he just died to prove his point, on the shoulder and says, as for sitting or standing and passing away, you're not lacking. But as for our teachers teaching, you haven't got a friggin' clue. Anyway, that is actually using the exact same expression of to pass away sitting or standing, because probably what happened is monks would naturally, when they knew their time was coming, and there are many accounts of it, they would sit in meditation and they would die. When I went to Korea about 30 years ago, I went to visit Kusan, 9 mountains, a famous Korean master. Got on the airplane, opened the newspaper. No, I didn't open the newspaper. It was on the front page. That's right. On the front page, death of High Master Kusan Sunim, and the picture of him and the president of the country had sent this wreath of flowers. Oh, my God. I show my friend who I was going. We're going to his funeral. We're not going to meet him. You know? Anyway, I got to the funeral, and what they did in Sungwangsa, the monastery there, is they go a few miles away from the monastery. They dig a pit, and the master died sitting in meditation, so they built a box with him still sitting in it, and then they lit a fire and they burned it. And when I went, I think it was the next morning, it was still burning, and you could see, you know, the head was kind of like this, you know. But he was still, the body was still sitting in meditation. Well, probably the Zen monks being the way they are, after a couple of generations of sitting like that, they said, I think I'm going to stand and do it. Actually, the founder of Myoshinji, supposedly asked for his staff and his sandals, to go out on his pilgrimage. He got his stick and put his sandals on with his attendant's help, and then he died standing like that. You can still go to the place, it's 10 minutes from my university, where supposedly this happened. His temple is still there. So yes, sitting, that's not bad, huh? But now we'll do it standing. Hell, you know what, I think I'm going to walk into my grave. Well, this can become a bit of a top that. The point, of course, is such freedom in living that when the time comes to die, you freely die, sitting, standing. This is the great matter of life and death resolved. It's not thoughts about it. Without, again, this is a preliminary. This is a process. This is helping us along the way. Without the concentrated power of dhyana and also living a wholesome life, any glimpse that we gain is likely to do more harm than good. By all means, give yourself fully to the moment-to-moment practice without having to think about when, where, how. Just give yourself to the moment-to-moment practice. Don't worry about it. If you get a glimpse too soon, it can be less than worthless. It can actually be an obstacle. So don't greedily seek after some kind of an experience. It just takes you away from the immediate practice. There's one thing that I have difficulty with in this quote. He talks about being, it is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana, literally dependent, relying on the concentrated power of dhyana, we're able to freely pass away standing or sitting. In what sense is this dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana, I ask you? Please take a moment to stand up, but don't die, okay? The next paragraph, quote, "Even if you devote your life to it, be wary of falling short. And if you waste your time, how in the world will you overcome your karmic hindrances? Thus, an ancient has said that without the concentrated power of dhyana, you will cower at death's door. With eyes covered, you end your life in vain like a vagabond." End quote. It's a striking contrast with the previous paragraph where he's saying can freely pass away sitting or standing, huh? The concentrated power of dhyana. But if you don't, it almost sounds like, I remember as a child, the pastor talking about what would happen if we went to heaven and what would happen if we went to hell. Well, he's trying to rouse us to proper practice, huh? He seems eager to warn us not to be lax, not to be lazy, and to make best use of this precious life that we have. Huh? What are you waiting for? Huh? Better circumstances than this? Hmm? Good luck. Please don't waste your life in vain, slowing down then speeding up the mind train, huh? Or redecorating the cars, huh? Putting some mandalas in there maybe, huh? Just a couple of koans. Huh? One thing that does need clarification, the karmic hindrances. What is that? Huh? Might sound to the Western ear a bit vague, esoteric, maybe strange, huh? But once we give ourselves to the practice, huh, the stubborn force of habitual attitudes, huh, becomes clear, doesn't it, huh? There are moments when things become crystal clear, huh? Thought is gone and there is utter clarity, and yet 10 minutes later you may find yourself going into the same old loop again, huh? Hmm? Hmm? Does anyone not know what I'm talking about? Hmm? Such entrenched tendencies, huh? They don't disappear as easily as discursive thought does, huh? Sit for retreat. Give yourself to sitting for a couple of days in discursive thought. You see the nothing that it is. Huh? But these underlying attitudes, huh, that we have, huh, they don't disappear, dissolve so easily, or even if they do, they tend to come back through the dynamic of our activities in the in our daily life, huh? Phone call from the mother or the mother-in-law, right? Things can start to churn, right? The same old wheels, huh? That's where we really need to be able to apply ourselves. It's easy to let discursive thought be dissolved, but that just makes it so much clearer what still remains to be done, and precisely why we do a retreat like this, not just a day sit where you can already usually get some sense of discursive thought fading away, but to see what my teacher Fukushima used to very simply speak of it as unconscious delusions. He used to say, oh yeah, the conscious delusions, you're aware of them. Just take some work to get through that. You're aware of it. But those unconscious delusions that are manipulating us, perhaps without even our awareness, huh? Before we are thinking, they're already working at work. Huh? Oh, yeah, that can take some work. That's why we sit through the night. Because then, remember all those demons? That's not just silly stuff, huh? Stuff is coming up, that's right. Take a look. We'll talk more tomorrow about this because it's intimately connected with taking this practice from here back to the streets, huh? Back to our daily life. Huh? These karmic hindrances, if you have not become intimate with them, I trust soon enough you will. Now let's return to that notion of dependent on circumstances. Huh? In the paragraph before, he was talking about dependent on the circumstance of sustained jhana practice. We're able to sit and pass away. Huh? All the virtues, in a sense, sound like they come out of this concentrated jhana. Huh? Yes and no. I would say dependent on circumstances, those karmic hindrances may return again and again. That is dependent on circumstances. That is why we're able to work it through and work it out. That's why we live a wholesome life and patiently maintain our practice. If you haven't had an insight yet, a realization, patiently continue your practice. And if you have, patiently continue your practice. It's at least as important then. Whether anything is dependent on it or not, the concentrated power of jhana continues. The final paragraph. Fortunate Dharma friends, please read this manual again and again. For the benefit of oneself as well as others, let us all together fully awaken. End quote. That's the end of the Zazen manual. You see that it ends where it began, right? Compassion awakening all. The name for this teacher as a Zen master is literally compassion awakening. He is the Chan master of compassion awakening. Compassion awakening all. Seeing what really is this prajna wisdom, that which we aspired to in the beginning, we find it's not separate from the compassion that we started with. This is our actual ground. It is also what we ceaselessly aspire to. Numberless beings set free, endless delusion, not let's go, let go. How fortunate we are, If you have not already, please confirm it yourself. There's no other way. And if you have, by all means, continue on. Fukushima Roshi would be delighted. He would be belly laughing his way through this retreat, knowing there were so many people here that had actually known him, many who had actually practiced with him, coming together here, continuing the tradition. As many of you know, his name as a Zen master, Koyuken, comes from the poem. It means deeper still. It comes from the poem, Tori Naite Yamasara Niyu Nari. So a bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. It's from a famous Chinese poem. Actually, the older poem, a couple of hundred years before, said, Icho Nakazu, not even one bird singing. Yamasara Niyu Nari. Without one bird singing, the mountain stillness deepens. But a couple of hundred years later, perhaps more or less with the influence of Zen, a great poet changed just one character. He made it positive rather than negative. Instead of not one bird, complete silence. No, the bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. This is a living silence that cannot be broken. If the truck goes by or the pain in the knee fires up, that is just the living expression of this silence that cannot be broken. If it can, break it. The bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. You see why I'm a sucker for these Zen phrases, huh? Any one of them, any one of them, it's all there. Nothing extra, nothing lacking. It may take a lifetime, but that's okay. I suppose that bird song is Fukushima's smile, his belly laugh. It's ours, too. In the Blue Cliff Record, one of the most interesting koans is one about the point of Bodhidharma coming from the West. This is a kind of a general expression. What is the truth? What is the ultimate truth? And for various reasons, it came to be expressed many ways. One way was, what's the point of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? If we're already awakened, if all beings have Buddha nature, why did he have to make that dangerous trip that took a few years and then sit in a cave for years? They said his legs withered away. He sat so long waiting for someone worthy to come. What's the point? What's the point? Well, as many of you know, literally hundreds of answers have been given over the centuries to this question. Many of them have been recorded. But the one that's relevant here is the monk, let's call him Steve, says, even more simply, what is Buddha? What is Buddha? Not even Bodhidharma. What is Buddha? Who is Buddha? What is Buddha? The great awakened one. And the master says, you, Steve, It's you. How do you get around that one, huh? It's you. Only a Buddha can fully accept that and recognize it. But that Buddha is Steve, Marty, John, Jim, Joe. Isn't it, huh? There is no other. There is no other. Usually in Buddhism, they speak of bodhisattvas, aspiring, the beginning of this text even, aspiring to be a bodhisattva. That is our goal. A Buddha, that's a special category. A Buddha, that's a special category. We aspire to be bodhisattvas. But in Zen, they cut even that division. And they speak of things like Buddhas and patriarchs. Or in this case, what is the Buddha? And the master has the nerve to say, you. What do you do with that? Do you sit with it? Do you stand with it? Do you walk with it? Do you giggle about it? What do you do with it, huh? What can you do with that? Sing like a bird? Does anyone have a question or concern? Yes.
I just wanted to see if I got the sequence the way you outlined it. So jhana allows us to calm the waves. What that means is slowing the train to the point where it comes to a full stop. When that happens, the pearl of itself is there. And that means instead of thinking I see each other in his or her or its complete unique individuality as not separate from me, as not separate from the root. But that's only the beginning of Zen. There, after that, I start working on the karmic hindrances so that I live that, what I see, I live it out every moment.
That's a pretty good summary, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Could you give an example? You mentioned an unconscious delusion or a tendency that you're not aware of, but that specifically can be revealed in a retreat like this.
Very simple. You may be sitting very, very deeply, and then you get up to go to a meal, and maybe you see one of the faces of one of the participants or one of the nuns, the staff, huh? And whatever reason, that face reminds you, that face is the face of someone that you had a really tough time with, or maybe someone you fell in love with, huh? And you don't have to think, you know what I mean? You don't have to think about it. A whole rush of things comes from that, you know, that person didn't intend to bring it to you. They just walked by. But because of our personal lives, our karma, as it's very generally termed, what someone else would just see as, oh, that was a person walking by. You all of a sudden, right? It just shoots right through you. And maybe all kinds of things start to come up now. Anger, jealousy, resentment, or love, it could be. You see what I mean?
And can those things still come up out of the practice without a trigger like that? Like where you're actually just sitting and then for no reason a bunch of resentment or anger or something can just come up?
Yeah, well, all I can say is we don't see what has prompted it. But yes, sometimes sitting very deeply, incredible things. Again, are they demons? Is this what they're talking about? Well, perhaps that's part of it. But just to say it's a demon doesn't mean it's completely unreal and you just ignore it. Sometimes these things Where do they come from? Cosmic, unconscious, you know, we can give explanations. It doesn't matter. It comes. And sometimes it's just overwhelming. But if we're really, that's why he keeps plugging away this concentrated power of dhyana. So when that does come, we can let it just be what it is. You see? Just be what it is. We don't have to, in a sense, even do anything with it. If we can purely let it just come, we can purely let it just go. And maybe we learn something, huh? We learn something about our relation with someone who, again, that person walking by just because it was a similar face. You know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how, why? You can talk with a specialist about it, I guess, but it happens. That's all I can say. It happens. And if we're deeply settled in our sitting, that very experience, that very karmic hindrance becomes the path. It becomes something that we're grateful for and that we learn from. It becomes our teacher. That's why Rinzai says these ridiculous things like the grave sins themselves become the great ocean of emancipation, one of his most famous expressions. We put that up in a big sign in the new Kyoto station when they redid it. Nobody had a clue what we were talking about. Even the vice president of the university, that we blew that one. It was just, you know, people, you know, businessmen on the elevator going by or on the escalator, and it's about like 3 seconds. What? You know? He's on the way to buy some shiseido for his wife or something. This is in Kyoto Station, not a monastery. Anyway, it's a wonderful expression. Not even the karmic hindrances. He's saying the five grave sins, the worst things you can do, kill your mother, kill your father. You can't kill a Buddha, that's going over. So they say, injure a Buddha. Kill a Bodhisattva. And the worst one of all is what? The worst one is to disrupt the unity of the Sangha. That's worse than killing your mother or your father. Disrupting the unity of the Sangha. The community of practitioners, us, disrupting this unity. That's the worst. But even more radical, he then says, those grave sins themselves become the great ocean of emancipation. He's not saying go out and kill your mother. Not at all. He's saying whatever you encounter, especially those things, if we are truly settled, they become grist for the mill, the great ocean of emancipation. Doesn't mean you go around trying to make mistakes, of course not. But is that okay? You want
to? It does. It made me think of the term I don't really know anything about, but storehouse consciousness. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of?
Well, yeah, that's a technical Buddhist term for. It's very interesting because way before we had any kind of modern psychology, so-called, Buddhism already speaks of it as a kind of a root storehouse consciousness where all of the experiences is. It's there, but we're not aware of it, and a certain occurrence or deep zazen can open that stuff up. It's all there. But that's fortunately, Zen tends not to deal with that stuff. But in Mahayana Buddhism, it's a very central notion. Yeah. David, did you want to say something?
Yes, Jeff, follow up on the question that you just talked about in terms of seeing our own karmic action, subconscious. Could you speak a little bit about how that, when the self starts to drop away, it's a collective consciousness. And there's things that come out of cultures, that come out of society, that come out of something much bigger. Can you talk to that a little bit?
If I have to, do I have time, head monk?
Yes, we have
time. We have to follow our conditions here, you know. Is that right? I will go into it tomorrow. Is there something specific you want to ask about now?
No, it's just a follow on to the very, sometimes they hit us and we don't, it comes out of some place that we don't also know, but we don't
yeah.
know if it's within our own karmic or it's something that's beyond
that. Yeah, but in Buddhism, it's interesting because they don't even make a clear cut. Where do you draw the line? Huh? It's like, well, that wasn't me, that was you. Well, in a sense, it's irrelevant. That's why they speak of the storehouse. It's all in there, and every one of us carries it around. And, you know, there have been scholars who connect that up with Jung, and, you know, it's very interesting, but this was done 1,500 or 2,000, almost 2,000 years ago, the development. It was really brilliant, but it's, you know, it's a very philosophical notion too, and I don't think it's so helpful to go into it. But the basic point I think we're all really in profound agreement on is this shit comes up. I don't know where it comes from, but it sure does come, and we need to figure out how to deal with it. Huh? Judy, you want to respond to that? Yeah. Yeah, it's also impossible, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's also impossible, isn't it?
Yeah.
To just identify with that stuff.
But we do.
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Impossible or not.
Yeah. You may remember before we even got halfway through the Zazen manual, already he said, let go of all thoughts, good and bad. You know, we don't even have to deal with that. Because in a sense, the bad thoughts, well, yeah, I mean, any ethical person is going to want to try and, but the good thoughts, there's where you really need some mature practice, because we naturally tend to, you know, being the biggest no-self around, you know, we tend to want to hold on, and then we turn that into something. Yeah, yeah, it's a good point, Judy, thank you.
Yeah. When he's talking about maintaining the concentration of jhana as a way of overcoming the karmic hindrances, is he talking about like shifting to kind of Buddha nature? Because it sounds like he's kind of encouraging like a consistent samadhi.
Yeah, yeah. But what would it mean to have, what did you say, to switch
like over? Just kind of like shifting. So like when you, during your talk, when you talked about kind of slowing the train down, having come to a complete stop, you know, when that kind of comes to a complete stop, the pearl reveals itself. So Buddha nature reveals itself, and kind of a shift happens of you just realizing what you truly are, as opposed to the movement of the train. But it just sounds like he's kind of encouraging this kind of constant effort.
Yeah, effort.
I know, but it's almost like to kind of achieve that jhana concentration.
Do you see why? Do you see why? It's not really, that's why I was giving him a hard time about dependent on. Because it's not literally the cause of awakening. There is no, there doesn't need to be a cause. And yet, we put all of our effort in the beginning into, and then when we've gone beyond our effort, we still give all of ourselves to develop. What are we doing here for? You know, you could be going golfing, Anthony. Come on, you know? This isn't fun. You know, why are we doing this? To develop this concentrated power of jhana in order to get enlightened? Not exactly. No, we don't need to. But do you see why we do that? Once something does turn over, how to say, the field has been cultivated, and we can then bring that to life we can then see, oh, I still have many karmic hindrances I need to work on, rather than without that kind of cultivation, pew, you just go off into space, you know, people, and they, you know, you could go crazy.
I mean, it's very kind of reminiscent of Theravada and Buddhism, Vipassana, and kind of cultivating the anapana,
yeah,
sati,
yes,
and kind of achieving that kind of equipoise,
yes,
to when these complexes do arise,
yeah,
one has this kind of relaxed state of mind,
mm,
to not react,
mm,
and allow it to.
Yeah, in Zen it's interesting because it almost turns that on its head as well. So it says not when something like that comes, but when great awakening comes. The classic example is Rinzai himself. Whether it's true or not, we don't know, but it, the record as it stands now, when he finally had his great awakening, you know what he said? Is that all there is to it? You know, literally, is that all there is to my teacher's Buddha Dharma?
It's a non-event.
Yeah. Is that it? You know, because he was banging his head against the wall for years. He was sitting so purely, you know, he was considered the pure monk 3 years. You know, he, of course he did, but he never moved from his cushion, you know. He just said, he didn't even know what to ask. He didn't even go to the master to ask a question because he was so into it, he couldn't formulate a question. Nowadays, it's, oh yeah, he didn't know what to ask. Well, do you realize where he must have been to not even have a question? For 3 years sitting? But then when he finally broke, you know the story, right? It's maybe a little bit legendary to make it more of a point, but he actually goes to his teacher and asks, what is the ultimate meaning of the Buddha Dharma? What is the truth? And before he finishes asking his question, his master slaps him. And he does it several times. And finally he says, I must have some karmic hindrance that is preventing, because the teacher is obviously a great compassionate one. I don't get it. He just keeps hitting me. I can't even finish asking the question. It's not helping, sorry. But he actually uses, if not the same, a similar term. There must be some karmic hindrance in me. So I'm leaving. I'm going to try it somewhere else. So then the master says, okay, but don't go anywhere else but to this guy's place, Koan place. So he goes to this guy's place. Almost nothing is known about the guy. And then they have an exchange, you know, the typical Zen humor. Rinzai lays his plaint. He says, I went 3 times to ask my teacher about the meaning of the Buddha Dharma, 3 times, and 3 times he just slapped me. I don't know where my fault is. And then the teacher said, why, your master was treating you entirely with grandmotherly kindness, and yet you have the balls to come here and say you don't know where your fault is? He broke that. That was what did it. At which point he says, was that all there is to it? That's how I translate it. Literally, it's something, not much to it. There's not much to it. But literally, is that it? Yeah. Oh, well, why didn't you tell me I had 5 fingers? I knew that all along. It's not some, you know, it's finally coming to a full and complete stop and seeing that you have 5 fingers. I thought I knew that. Again, maybe it's a little made up, but what Rinzai, the father of Rinzai Zen, said upon his great awakening was, is that all there is to it? Is that all there is to my teacher's Buddha Dharma, you know? Getting slapped around and going from here to there. But do you see how that's connected? Does that mean he doesn't have any more karmic hindrances? Rinzai Zen wants to say yes, but if you read the record of Rinzai carefully, there's a place where he comes back to visit his teacher. And he's a little full of himself. And he sees his teacher. He's reading, probably preparing for a lecture, so he's reading the Chinese text. And Rinzai says, oh, I thought you were a great master, but you're just an old bean-eating fart. You know, because the beans, characters, the children look like beans. So, you know, he's just making a kind of, I say, you're just an old bean-eating fart. And you have a little bit of a back and forth. And his teacher says, he actually came after the training period began, which you're not supposed to do. And he said, oh, I just came to pay my respects to you. That's all. Anyway, they put him in the zendo for a couple of days, and then he decides to leave. And the master, again, he's pissed. The master says, you came after the training season began, and now you're leaving before it ends. You know, he's just so full of his freedom, you know? And but again, it means like, it's okay. Where are you going? If not north of here, I'm going, you know, he gives all these really free Zen expressions. And the master kind of strikes him and pushes him out. And then it says, Rinzai went some way and had a doubt. And then he went back and finished the training period. You don't hear the Rinzai masters talking about that, but there's one master 300 years ago who wrote, because of that doubt, Rinzai Zen is still alive today. Rinzai Zen is still alive today. Sorry. Speaking of the concentrated power of jhana, maybe we should get back to our zazen. David, I'm sorry we didn't do justice to your question, but we will return to it tomorrow. And if you're not satisfied, you kick butt tomorrow, all right? Okay. Sorry to have taken so long, but it looks like there's some stuff that needed to come up, huh? Thank you for bringing it up. Let us continue, huh? Thank you again.